interview with Conrad Dannenberg. And one of the first things that I was curious about is why the people at AVMA ever started thinking about this cluster thing in the first place. Because the Air Force, this is in the 57 time frame, the Air Force had been given authority to do missiles over 200 miles. So this left AVMA kind of up in the air with some of their plans.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden comes this proposal for this gargantuan booster. Why? Who? How did that evolve? Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about
that? Well, of course, in a way, it evolved before this decision was made that the Army was limited to these other things. People had been working on it before, on a study phase, not in actual hardware periods. Yeah. So in a way, it was an old concept. And of course, the question how to increase the thrust of an engine has always been under discussion. In a way, really, the first cluster was the Atlas. Yeah. The Atlas had two engines and also the different booster engine, of course. Yeah. So you can call it a cluster. And I think certainly ever since that time, people thought about the question, what can we do to increase the thrust, and particularly if you want to increase it quickly. So if you don't have an awful lot of development time to develop a new, stronger engine. Because an engine development, as I'm sure you know from your historical studies here, takes normally quite a number of years.
Mm-hmm. But what was this thing going to be used for? As I recall later on, there was talk about the so-called Advent satellite that ARPA was in.
Mm-hmm.
But what was it? Was it just mostly to see how much more thrust you could get, or was there a specific kind of thing in mind?
Well, of course, the Army had also quite ambitious plans, and sometimes they really wanted to colonize the moon, or to at least have a station on the moon, let's better say, yeah.
Right.
I think colonization is not the right word, yeah. That's a little bit too controversial.
A permanent base,
right now.
I think it was.
It's a permanent base, yeah. Right, yeah. And, of course, for that you need an awful lot of power, yeah? Now, I don't think anyone had made detailed studies so that you knew exactly with what launch vehicle do you get where. But it was generally known and understood by everyone that you need an awful lot of power. And so the basic question was, how do you get a lot of power? Even the Saturn I and Saturn IB booster was really built on that basis, yeah? When we initially started the booster work, there was really certainly no Apollo program, yeah?
Yeah.
The Saturn, it was not called Saturn in those days, yeah? But the need for a big booster was generally assumed. Mm-hmm. And even all the early Saturn days left the upper stages, in particular the payload, still quite open. But people thought already about putting, for example, other vehicles like the Titan was quite a bit under study in those days. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had at some time a study with Martin to find out exactly what changes do they have to make on the Titan in order to put it on top of the first stage. Yeah.
And the dinosaur was in the same category.
Yeah. So I think it was a general recognition that we need strong boosters, big boosters, in order to get some of these type of payloads. And I think it was more a class of payloads that was under consideration to get them up into orbit. And again, as I said, people here realize that it takes a long, long time to develop big engines, and maybe people were also afraid of the many development problems, and it was just considered to be easier to cluster existing engines. And I think we also knew already that the Russians were doing the same kind of thing. The Russians have been taking the cluster approach from the very beginning. Yeah, even today, the booster they launched Soyuz with was a cluster booster.
Yeah. Now, yeah, the origins of the cluster concept interests me too, because in a sense, I guess you'd call it Atlas a cluster, but still, two wonderful.
Well, people normally don't call it a cluster.
Yeah, it was the. Two were the sustainer engines.
One sustainer in the middle, in the center. And two booster engines.
Two boosters.
Yeah.
So then how. The whole Saturn I, or the Juno 5 and the Saturn I, seems kind of like a bargain basement sort of thing.
It was, definitely. Just like the first booster, yeah?
Yeah.
Madeira said we can build the whole thing for $9 billion, I think was his figure, yeah? It was pretty low figure on there somewhere, yeah?
But how did the idea evolve that you would take, was it the Jupiter tank in the center and then cluster the red cell?
Mm-hmm.
How you remember anything about how that evolved? Was it very definite? Or?
Well, again, as you said, it was a bargain booster approach, yeah?
Yeah.
And of course, to really come to bargain booster prices, you have to use existing hardware, yeah? And that was the basic thought behind it. What can we use to exploit our existing hardware? And it was not so much, everyone saw that from the beginning, just to copy exactly what we have, but basically to use the tooling, yeah? I think everyone saw that we probably have to build new tanks, but what can we do to use our factory assembly lines, or
right.
Assembly lines, I think, is a proper word.
Yeah.
And what can we do to use existing tooling, which is very expensive and time-consuming to build, yeah?
Yeah, when you say new tanks, you meant new Redstone and new Jupiter tanks. Is that
right,
correct? Yeah.
Yeah.
Was there ever any plans at one time to build a gargantuan single tank?
Plans on paper,
five?
Yes.
Yeah.
But as soon as people looked at the paper plans, they realized it would have taken something like the Michoud facility we had in the long run, yeah? And of course, we didn't have that at that time, and there was not even a prospect of getting it, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So the only way to really get going, and I think that is one thing that Medeiros apparently had very clearly recognized and really pushed, yeah? He probably got the basic, the technical ideas from Vaughan and his team, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But Medeiros ran with it and said, well, for $9 million I can build such a thing, yeah? And he got to go ahead, and that was it, yeah? Then we were all in business.
But it was ARPA that really came through with the money.
Right, yeah. So in that sense, it was really not an Army assignment. The Army team just did this kind of work for ARPA, yeah? Therefore, this missile range business was really not that much under discussion.
There's something else that just occurred to me, too, now. Out there on the in the test facility area, I remember going by one and seeing a bunker that was constructed of an old tank car covered with dirt.
You probably think of the old Redstone.
But that was a Redstone.
The old Redstone. The very first Redstone test stand. We didn't have any test stand at that time.
Yeah.
And everyone felt that in order to test the engine and the assembly properly, of course, the engine had been built by North American. Yeah. So we just got it from North American and we just had to assemble the thing. But everyone felt that we just couldn't even go ahead with the design and finalize everything before we hadn't done some testing. And so again, we took the bargain basement approach and we used existing hardware. This was a chemical arsenal, so there were a lot of tanks around, yeah? So we used some of these tanks, we threw some sand around it, put some instrumentation on the inside and ran real simple cable trenches between the observation bunker and the actual test stand, which was also built really from scrap, from existing scrap, except of course for measuring instruments. Yeah, they had to be bought.
But this is for the Redstone,
the basic
not for the
structure.
Juno 5.
That was, well, of course, for the Juno 5, we again had the need to do some additional testing.
Yeah. Did you use the same bunker for the Juno 5 testing originally?
Yeah. For, well, no, I think by the time the Juno 5 came up, we had already the other test stand. We had already the big Redstone test stand. And so I think by the time we really talked about Juno 5, we were already in the real business. This was done in the real early days. We came here in 50, and so it must have been built in 51, 52. So I would say the testing started around 53 or so.
That strikes me as a national monument now, that thing. It really has a historical significance.
I haven't even thought of that. You know, our Space Museum is trying to declare a few local things as national monuments.
Good. Good.
Maybe they should include that. I think they have only included one of the big test stands.
Well, it seems to me
let me check this puck be there. You are right, that might be more of a monument than the real big impressive things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so now, and I was wondering too, in this same period, what the feeling was when the word started filtering down that ADMA was going to get transferred to the NASA organization. Do you remember that everybody was...
Well, of course, you know that it had been turned down once, yeah?
Yeah.
And at that time, at least all the key people discussed the subject quite a bit. And I think the main question was, well, in a way, I think the von Braun team, as I think even you have called it, yeah, they somehow felt loyal, not only to von Braun, but also to the basic employer, to the Army, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So to make such a switch looked a little bit almost like treason, yeah? So people didn't really like to do it. And on the other hand, of course, we knew that ARPA certainly had relatively big plans in those days, yeah? And I think on the other side, on the NASA side, we are not really aware of their plans, what they had in mind, yeah? And if NASA wouldn't have gotten the lunar landing project, I don't even know what would have become out of them, yeah? NASA, the old NACA, we should really say, yeah, of course, was more looked as a bunch of long hairs. They had a lot of wind tunnels, and they did a lot of scientific work in the lab. But I think they generally were not being regarded as too practical a group, yeah, in, let's say, the real true manufacturing sense.
Well, it was a very theoretical
really one, building big things, and I think that was our main concern, yeah?
Yeah.
And of course, we evaluated strictly from an NACA viewpoint, yeah? Mm-hmm. Now, of course, in the meantime, it had been decided already that the Milton Rosen, the Vanguard team, would go to NASA, which was being formed at that time, and JPL. I think JPL had been transferred earlier than the team here.
Right.
I think basically in 58. So basically when NASA was established, JPL was transferred.
Well, what strikes me, going to the documents, you know, that after NASA was formed, and they were talking about the broad gauge space program they wanted to do, there was really no expertise that they had. Been transferred from the old NACA. If they're going to get this expertise, and at that time what they needed was big boosters, there was only one place to go, and that was the DOD at ABMA.
Yeah.
General Operations. And I've come across a couple of memorandums, one of them from Jornovic. And I've forgotten the exact date, but it's about this period. And one of them says, I think we should go after ABMA in the strongest possible way. So they were out to get the ABMA people after.
Well, and finally they succeeded, yeah?
Yeah.
And I think in the long run, no one really regretted it, yeah? I think in the long run, everyone thought that this was the right decision.
Well, NASA certainly brought the money with them. What about the Silberstein Committee then in December of 1959 when they decided on the LH2? Now, I've heard some people have told me, and I've seen some references to the fact that von Braun himself wasn't very keen on liquid hydrogen technology. And of course, all the you and the people from Redstone just been working with Locke and RP1. Do you recall if there was really any strong antagonism about LH2 with an exotic?
Well, I don't think it was very strong, but people were really concerned. We, of course, knew already about the problems that the Centaur people had.
Yeah.
The General Dynamics was working on the Centaur, and we kept a pretty close eye on it. And they just ran into all kinds of problems people hadn't foreseen. And we saw our project more as a project that really wanted to do something fast. So we didn't want to tamper with all these development difficulties. So there was certainly a certain amount of antagonism. I don't think it was very strong, yeah. And again, after the decision had been made, I think people really jumped on the bandwagon and then carried it even with inner conviction that this was the right way to go, because of course, purely performance-wise, everyone saw immediately that this gave us so much more than any other combination would have given, yeah?
Yeah, the I-specific of LH2 was the thing that really makes the whole thing work at the end.
Yeah.
Okay, so there was this concern about because the Centaur experience.
Yeah, right, the Centaur experience. Again, it was a new project. I think our people, as I said before already, were generally always very conservative, yeah? So for that reason, the switch to NASA was difficult. Yeah, it was a basic change even in life approach, in very principle, yeah? And this was, again, another basic change. And as I pointed out before, I think at the time when the decision was made, we had already a contract with Martin to put the Titan on top of the S1 first stage booster, yeah? And again, everything had to be changed again, yeah? And people are always reluctant, not only this team here, but I think most people are reluctant to make basic changes, yeah? And that's, of course, what was necessary. But after this decision had been made, after it was decided by top side to go this direction, I think then we really had full support from everyone and from top management on down all the line to the engineers. Of course, the engineers probably were even quite happy because now they had really something to bite their teeth in again, yeah? Some new development problems, and that's always what they are looking for.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, now this brings us around about the time the S1C starts cooking, mm-hmm. in 1961. And some of the questions I had there relate to this unusual, it seems to me, relationship that Marshall had with Boeing.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could explain to me why Marshall took this unusual role with Boeing. When they'd already given, as a matter of fact, the contract to Douglas to do the S-4 and the S-4B, and they just kind of gave the contract, and we said, okay, mm-hmm. go. But with Boeing, it was entirely different. Can you explain to me the rationale and reasoning behind this?
Well, of course, firstly, Boeing had really made an outstanding proposal, yeah? So they really won the competition, and it was a pretty fierce competition at that time, who gets the S1C.
Mm-hmm.
So Boeing had really won it on the basis of their excellent proposal.
What features of the proposal stood out? Do you remember that?
Well, good management, a good technical approach. I think the thing that really finally won it for Boeing was a good technical approach, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And again, they took, and maybe that's what particularly swung this team in the direction towards Boeing. They took a very down-to-earth type approach, yeah? Mm-hmm. Relatively simple design. They didn't have double bulkheads, double tanks. They did not have very sophisticated designs.
Some of them came in with the common bulkhead?
Well, I don't recall the details of the other proposals, but mm-hmm. they were more sophisticated. They were more complicated, yeah? And Boeing was down to earth.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of that fact, the people here felt Boeing had never really built, of course, no one had really built ever such a big thing, yeah?
Yeah.
But other companies like Douglas and North American were a little bit closer to this kind of thing, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And it was an entirely new thing for Boeing. So for that reason, a lot of people here, particularly people on the working level, felt it was not the time to really let Boeing completely go on their own. And for that reason, people here felt, and of course we also wanted to have the pride of authorship, so to speak, yeah?
Is that a part of it, you think?
The first units had to be built here, yeah?
Yeah.
Particularly the test units, and of course everyone figured that also probably the first one or two flight units had to come out of our own shops in order to be sure the thing works. To be sure we take the right development approach in all little details, in detailed design of the tanks, of the lines, of the tie-in to the engines and so forth. And for that reason, Boeing got the free rein only relatively late in the game. I think that's what you were referring to, yeah?
Yeah,
they were really led by the hand.
If somebody like Douglas, for example, had gotten the contract and they were already doing things, would there have been such a close relationship then, you think, or would there have been more inclination to let Douglas go a little bit more on their own? Or was it the fact that Boeing had not built such a large rocket base before that they were brought in?
And also, of course, the fact was that Boeing didn't have their own facility, yeah? Douglas had their own facilities where they were building these things. And of course, at that time, we were considering already Michu. I think it was even a part of the contract. I don't recall that detail right now.
But I think the part of the RFP was to come in and build it in Michu.
Yeah,
yeah, I'd forgotten that because I was talking to Matt Erlob the other day. He commented, too, that part of the thing was that Michu was, in comparison to all our facilities on the West Coast, Michu was in the backyard almost, and it was part of the Marshall complex.
Yeah.
So there was.
And we also saw much easier transportation conditions, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Going to the West Coast, we had to depend on the Panama Canal. And maybe some people saw already what is coming now.
Yeah.
And to ship it all the way around South America, of course, would be a tremendously long trip, yeah? Even the Panama Canal is almost a month's trip from Seattle, yeah? If you have to pick it up in Seattle and ship it then through the canal to the Cape.
So how much did Boeing... You say they really had a good technical proposal. Did this proposal go pretty far down the line then and how the S1C finally came out, or did Marshall really set up pretty much the general
outline? Of course, when Boeing got the contract, we had not decided on the number of engines yet, yeah?
We knew
what engine to put on, yeah?
Yeah.
We had only one that could do the job, but how many of those we needed, that was not clear. And one of the reasons it was not clear was, of course, the whole lunar mission was not clear at that time, yeah? Like the lunar orbital rendezvous had not been decided on, yeah? There were a number of other possibilities that were also being studied. And again, I think after the final decision had been made, really everyone backed it. Up to that point, there were big fights on, yeah? And particularly a lot of people here at Marshall felt this was not the right way to go. Mm-hmm. And what our people would have liked to see is to have Earth orbital rendezvous. To put relatively small payloads up, we could even have done that with the S1C, with the Saturn 1 booster.
Yeah.
Maybe the 1B,
but
not the S1C. Yeah? We would not have needed the Saturn 5. Mm-hmm. And we would have put all the orbital hardware then in four or five shots into an Earth orbit, and we would have made Earth orbital rendezvous to assemble all the hardware. And of course, the big advantage we would have had if we would have gone that way. We would then have had a space station already in the mid-60s. Because these conditions led automatically to a space station. Yeah. Even a very fancy space station which can really do orbital assembly work. On the other hand, for that reason, NASA headquarters decided against it. They saw too many development problems, too many possibilities that something would go wrong. They didn't even see the possibility to get five launches off on a fairly tight time schedule. Yeah. And they figured it is better to build one big booster and to depend on just one launching date. Yeah? And if you get that one launching date off, then you are in business. Mm-hmm. And so finally they went to the lunar orbital rendezvous after many, many discussions, many studies, many heartbreaking decisions. And of course that then only finally decided the number of engines we need on the booster. Yeah.
Two questions. Was there a trade-off?
And again, I think Boeing showed a lot of inventiveness, how these things could be added. I think they showed more flexibility in that respect, since they had a very basically simple approach, yeah,
mm-hmm.
to the whole layout.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically a boiler tank design, yeah. But again, it had flexibility, yeah? And to add engines was no real big sweat at all, yeah?
That reminds me of comments I've heard so much about Marshall's approach was very conservative. But it was that very conservatism that gave it flexibility in the long
term. Yeah.
It had a large reserve built into it.
And I think in that sense, we were on the same wavelengths, on the same phase with Boeing, yeah? They apparently saw it our way and they went along with it. And that may even have weighed a little bit in the final evaluation of their proposals, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what our people like, so they got plus points in all these areas. And some of the other companies, probably particularly North American, they always are a little bit more further out. They are much more inclined to stick their neck out. And sometimes our people are a little bit reluctant to go all that far. And I think rightfully so, because if you really look back, I personally think it's amazing that we have launched all these Saturn boosters now, some 30 or so of them, yeah? And not a single real big failure. There were little things that happened during flight, yeah? But they were all very minor. And basically, I think you have to say each and every one of the at least booster launches was a success. And even, we never lost any astronauts in flight, yeah? Even the very bad Apollo 13 incident, yeah? It still brought the people back. And the only thing that did happen really happened on the ground, and you certainly cannot blame the booster for it, yeah?
It was the fire.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When about the time of the EOR, LOR decision, when Marshall finally agreed then to go, because they were still pushing the EOR concept, and you mentioned the fact that there was this space station thing too floating around at that time. Did Shea or anyone at headquarters suggest, you know, that okay, we'll go with a single booster now and we'll talk about space stations later on? Was it kind of a carrot and stick kind of thing?
Well, I think the space station discussion just didn't impress anyone in headquarters. Yeah, it was not their job. They were not really concerned with space stations.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have the Johnson Space Center in those days, yeah, so these people were not pushing in that direction. It was just a small little space group.
Mm-hmm.
Operating out of what was it? Was Goddard? No, Langley, out of Langley.
Yes, TG, yeah.
Yeah. And so really no one worried about it, and certainly headquarters didn't worry about it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was only our desire, let's say, yeah. And again, we didn't have any real mission requirement for it either. Mm-hmm. If someone would have asked for it, we probably could have come up with a mission requirement, but it was just not one of the issues. And for that reason, of course, that concept lost out. And particularly, people were afraid that we had to launch a relatively large number of boosters on relatively short notice.
And if you missed the launch window on one,
yeah, then the whole mission,
two or three,
yeah, particularly if you have trouble with your hydrogen launch, yeah, and of course we had decided already to go to the hydrogen route,
yeah.
So if you don't get your hydrogen up by the time you get the next launching, then all your hydrogen has vaporized,
yeah.
And for that reason, people decided this is just not the way to go.
Okay, what about the origin of the fifth engine? I have a little trouble tracing that down because when the S1C first came out, of course, it was a four-engine.
Yeah.
Third.
Initially, we even started on two, yeah? The initial
yes,
proposal
yeah.
was made on two or four. We knew already that the possibility would come up that we might have to go to four.
And at that time,
I think we never considered three. I have never seen anything considering three engines.
But it was at that time, well, I think it was either a 2 or 4, it was even called an S1B.
Stage. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the final calculations, as always in these things, yeah, by the time you add up all your instrumentation and the lunar lander, the lunar excursion module, by the time you add all these things, the thing was just too heavy, and four engines just couldn't hack it.
Mm-hmm. So, but there's a correspondence that comes out of Milton Rosen's office.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in November of 61, and the impression that's given there is that it was a headquarters decision to go with five engines, and it was really a headquarters
mm-hmm.
move to do this thing.
Well, again, I think most of the problems I just mentioned are really not so much Marshall problems, yeah? They were probably more tied to the man portion of the vehicle, and of course their headquarters had also a better insight than our people here, yeah? They knew already a little bit more what was coming. They worked much closer with the space task group than we did here. The tie into the space task group was really not too strong in those days. Yeah. In fact, that is one of the reasons that we set up all these working groups. I'm sure you have read a lot about the working groups and the panels. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was really just an attempt to get closer to these people and to get some continuous inputs and feedbacks from their side.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the working groups were more our own management device here at Marshall to work with our own contractors. And the panels, and other group of working groups in a way, yeah, it's
yeah.
basically the same setup. But that was more with the man portion of the project, yeah, to really get the input from the space task group and to be aware of what these people wanted to do and what their requirements are. And I am not even aware of this Rosen letter. I don't recall that I've ever seen it.
Yeah,
but I think basically in principle, without knowing all the documented background, yeah, I think I agree that there was a strong push on from headquarters at least to add a fifth engine, yeah.
Well, there was a special committee that was set up, and there were some Marshall people on it, and I want to get in touch with them. One of them was Marcik and Hans.
Marcik was very active in the whole design, in the whole layout, yeah. He was also very instrumental in making these kind of decisions, yeah. How many engines do we need? Why do we need them? What are the requirements? So he would certainly be the right man to do it.
Bonnie
and he made a lot of these decisions in the form that he presented them to von Braun, yeah.
Yeah.
Von Braun was really the one to make for Marshall the final decision and said yay or nay, that's the way we go or we don't, yeah.
Yeah.
Although of course he certainly didn't do all the work himself, yeah. He had a lot of people supporting him.
Oh yeah.
And Marcik was one of the key people to make a lot of these key decisions.
Yeah. What was Marcik's position at that time? Was he in PNVE or something?
I think he was not the boss of PNVE at that time. On the other hand, I'm not too sure. He may even have been the boss. You should look at some old organization charts. But he was certainly one of the key people in PNVE, and he was in charge of this kind of design work. Yeah. I think we still had Klein in.
Klein
was the boss.
Yeah.
And he was here only very temporarily. And I think after... No, when was Heidel the boss down there? No, I think that was before Klein. Yeah, I think Marcik took over from Klein.
Oh,
and he was certainly one of the key people. He was probably in charge of the structural or maybe the layout group or some group like that, who was in charge of looking into these things and making these kind of very basic design decisions.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the questions I'll have to ask him about then.
Yeah. And, get it and if you talk with him, you certainly talk with the right man. Yeah.
Sticking
with it. In fact, at that time, I was basically so much in charge of renegotiating contracts from two engines to four engines that I normally waited for these inputs to come in, yeah?
Yeah.
So I didn't even go to all the meetings because there were so many meetings. There were meetings going on all the time, yeah? And you just couldn't go to all of them.
Yeah.
But that was Marcek's job, to go to the meetings, to represent our viewpoint, to have our say in these things.
Mm-hmm.
And he also was in charge of making all the necessary studies for that kind of thing. And I think it was more really an advanced studies group that he must have been heading, yeah? Because, of course, it was not really ready yet to go into detailed design, yeah? That was the next phase.
Yeah, P&B really didn't come about as a separate thing until after 63,
After really these basic decisions had been made, and then it was a matter of now really coming up with a detailed design, yeah? And I think that was the time when Marcek took over. So he was one of the fortunate advanced designers that could really implement that design, yeah.
Why did the S1C have two separate propellant tanks as opposed to a common bulkhead?
Well, again, that was a very conservative approach of Boeing, yeah. That was kicked around quite a bit. Should we have